Vamos ao. Boa tarde a todos.
Good afternoon. We're now going to start this afternoon's first panel, the topic of which is the impact on organisations. We're already a little bit late, so we're now going to start immediately. And we have, as our speakers, we have four speakers this afternoon. We have an hour and a half. And so we're going to have about an hour for the initial presentations, and then we're going to have half an hour for discussion. Our speakers, as you know, we have interpretation, and so I'm going to speak in Portuguese. We have one foreign speaker, David Wright, and we're going to follow the order on the program. David Wright is the director of the company Trilateral Research Limited that has worked in this area a great deal, especially on contracts for the EU. And David Wright is the author of three famous books on questions related to privacy. And then the next speaker will be Patricia Geronimo, who is the data protection officer. And so, mobility and transport, she worked in telecom, Portugal Telecom and Mail, so she's worked in the area of telecommunications. Then we are going to hear Pedro Dias Vicente, who's responsible for compliance in the auditing department of the EDP Group and has a great deal of experience as a consultant in a number of areas, not only in the area of data protection, but in other, areas too. So then the last speaker will be Eugenia Santos, who is a member of the board of the Agency for Administrative Modernization. So with no further ado, I would like to give the floor to Mr. David Wright.
Thank you, Chairman. I'm really pleased to be here today. I do thank our hosts, CNPD, for inviting me here this afternoon. I have to say, I think this is the most beautiful room where I've ever presented something, so I'm really flattered to be here. And it's also nice to see everybody in the audience, because it looks like you're all in motion. You know, everybody's going like this, and it's like watching TV. Anyway, so I want to talk today about the impact of data protection impact assessment on business. It comes from Article 35 of the General Data Protection Regulation, about which we were talking this morning. I think some companies might view privacy protection or the need to protect privacy as a little bit like this. If I can move on. Sorry, Victor.
We need an expert.
This always happens, right?
Os slides que o David Wright vai mostrar não são privados.
The slides are not private. It's there for everyone to see. We're just trying to solve a technical glitch.
Okay, sure.
This is most better. I love that.
Just leave it. Oops. Okay, so I'm going to use the mouse. It's very sensitive, so if I go through a whole bunch of slides at once, I'll try to backtrack a little bit. So as I was saying, some companies might view privacy protection as a little bit like this. You know, it's like taking medicine. However, I don't think that's totally true. When I was preparing this presentation, I did some research on the internet, and I looked for the first companies that I could find mentioning privacy and data protection impact assessment, or privacy impact assessment. So the first three that I came to are the ones that are mentioned here. So this is British Telecom, one of the largest companies in the UK, and they're saying that they actually take a very serious, a very positive view of privacy. They feel that trust is very important to earn from their customers and their clients, and trust means transparency. And one of the ways to ensure transparency is through privacy impact assessments. And they say privacy impact assessments make sure everyone understands privacy issues right from the start. Next one I found was from the GSM Association. The GSM Association is the world's largest association of mobile telephone companies. And they think that privacy impact assessment is about identifying risks and reducing those risks to their customers and their clients and so forth. But interestingly, I think, is the third point, which they say is it's about designing a more efficient and effective process for handling data about individuals. So I think that's very important in terms of companies thinking about, you know, do I really have to do a data protection impact assessment? Next and the last company I'm going to cite here is Diageo, which is one of the world's largest drinks companies. They make all kinds of alcoholic beverages and so forth. And they said when planning a new project, you should carry out a privacy impact assessment. So they do that something as a standard practice. So what is a data protection impact assessment? Well, I think a data protection impact assessment is a way of ensuring that your company or your organization complies with the requirements of the General Data Protection Regulation. It's a way of assessing risks, privacy risks, and identifying solutions to those risks. And it's also a way of consulting with your stakeholders, of interacting with your stakeholders, whether they're customers or suppliers or associates or employees, any of those stakeholders. I think a data protection impact assessment should be viewed as a competitive advantage as well. So for an organization that conducts a DPIA, I think they're going to be more trusted than a company that doesn't conduct a data protection impact assessment. So I think there's a competitive advantage there. And most importantly, I think it's a way of showing to customers that the organization treats privacy seriously. It's not just it's not just some words in an annual report. It's something they actually view seriously. So Article 35 is the key article from the General Data Protection Regulation, and it says, it focuses on data protection impact assessment, and they identify four instances when a data protection impact assessment is mandatory. All companies must, all organizations must carry out a DPIA when the processing of personal data is likely to result in a high risk to the data subject's rights and freedoms. DPIA is mandatory when the processing involves automated decision making, when a computer is making a decision about data subjects that has legal effects. It's mandatory when the processing involves special categories of personal data. Special categories of personal data are like your religion, sexual orientation, whether you're a member of a trade union, your political views, and so forth. And finally, the systematic monitoring of a publicly accessible area on a large scale. So it means like a public surveillance system, for example. In addition to these four instances specifically mentioned in Article 35, the Article 29 Working Party, the collection of all data protection authorities across Europe, is considering examples of processings that might or might not require a data protection impact assessment. They're expected to come out with an opinion before the end of this year on other instances where a data protection impact assessment should be carried out or maybe not carried out. What would be some of those other examples? Well, the GDPR mentions a number of risks in Recital 75. If you look at the version of the GDPR that was adopted in April this year, and look at Recital 75, you'll find in there a number of different risks and harms to data subjects. And I would venture to say that the Article 29 Working Party will be focusing on these kinds of instances where a data protection impact assessment would be necessary. What is in a DPIA? Again, Article 35 mentions the sorts of things that should be included in a data protection impact assessment. They list a description of the processing and its purposes. Why are you processing personal data? Is the personal data processing, is it really necessary? Or if it is necessary, is it proportionate to the purposes of the processing? It should carry out an assessment of the risks to privacy. It should identify solutions to overcome those risks. It should comply with a code of conduct if a code of conduct exists. And the GDPR does encourage organizations to develop codes of conduct. The Article 35 says, where appropriate, a DPIA should include the views of data subjects. I disagree with that. I think a data protection impact assessment should always take into account the views of data subjects and stakeholders. I think taking into account the views of stakeholders or data subjects is what marks a data protection impact assessment. I don't think a DPIA, in my view, can be credible without taking into account the views of data subjects and stakeholders. And then if the project or the processing changes in some way, even after the DPIA is completed, I'm being reminded how many minutes I've consumed here. I think I'm going to have a couple of more reminders before I finish. And if there's some change in the project, then the DPIA should be revisited. So the kinds of impacts that a DPIA can have are financial, reputational, political, and regulatory. A financial impact covers the cost of undertaking the DPIA in the first place. So it involves the time of the assessor, the person who's undertaking the data protection impact assessment. It involves the time that it takes to consult with employees and external stakeholders, management's time, raising employee awareness. That's important for privacy. And then, of course, indirect costs as well. The regulation also says that controllers should adopt internal policies and measures that meet data protection by design. So when a company or an organization is developing a new technology, they should build privacy into the design of that new technology. So that's a cost. The precise cost depends on the scale of the DPIA. Is it a small-scale DPIA? Is it one that just affects the organization, or it may be a medium-scale DPIA where it affects not only the organization, but its customers, its clients, its users, and so forth, or it might be a large-scale DPIA. In each case, the costs are going to vary because you're going to consult with more stakeholders, you're going to do more research, and so forth. I think a DPIA has reputational impacts for the organization as well. If you do conduct a DPIA, it shows to customers and suppliers and staff and regulators and so forth that you take privacy seriously. If you don't conduct a DPIA, I would say that it shows the organization doesn't view privacy very seriously. It's not really important. Result of conducting a DPIA also has some the reputation of the organization, I think, can be enhanced by the credibility of the DPIA. If it's a serious DPIA, if it's something that's undertaken in a serious way and not just something that's cursory done in an afternoon, then I think that helps the credibility of the DPIA. The credibility is also depends on who conducts the DPIA, and also in some cases, for example, in the United States, government agencies publish their DPIAs or privacy impact assessments. A DPIA has political impacts as well. I think the existing Article 35, and indeed the data protection regulation, doesn't cover other types of privacy beyond data protection, or it mentions other types of privacy in a very superficial way. So there's things like privacy, behavioral privacy, or privacy of location, or privacy of communications, privacy of groups or association. Those other types of privacy are not covered in the GDPR. And then there's also ethical issues involved in many cases, like discrimination, for example. It's not really a privacy issue. Regulatory impacts, well, there's certainly Article 35 of the GDPR, and that is the most important article, I would say, for us in Europe. But there's also the Article 29 Working Party opinion that I mentioned a few minutes ago, and the International Organization for Standardization, the ISO, has developed a PIA standard. The ISO PIA standard is about 50 pages long, single space, very detailed. So, you know, what's going to be the balance of power, if you like, between Article 35 and the ISO PIA standard? And then there's also national PIA guidelines. Last slide. So I think a DPIA, in addition to those other impacts that I mentioned, has some positive impacts as well. It's a way of improving trust with your stakeholders. It's a way of learning how to cope with the GDPR. It's about identifying risks that might otherwise be overlooked. It's a way of learning from stakeholders. It's a way of developing a corporate history, if you like, what you've done in other DPIAs. It's a way of educating employees. And finally, as I mentioned, it's a competitive advantage. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much for your discipline. Seeing as David had prepared a 15 to 20 minute presentation, and I asked him to cut it down to 15, which he respected scrupulously, and I thank him very much for it. I'd kindly ask you not to photograph the slides where the private data is displayed.
Good afternoon. I work for a communications company, telecommunications company, and that focuses a great deal on data protection. And so at the moment I'm now in another public organization in order to start a long path in terms of data protection. Well, this is a very dynamic system that is always changing given the conditions. That exist. So my aim today is to tell you what a data protection officer does in a company. And so according to the regulation, the officer is mandatory in certain circumstances in an organized public organization, in an organization that makes a systematic control of sensitive data in the unit of Germany, in a when obliged in national law. So in this slide, I have specified, even though it doesn't have the name a data protection officer, I think it's very important for somebody to have a very good idea of what can be done. So the tasks is to control the conformity of the performance of the processor and can assess the risks and cooperate with the control authorities and be the contact point. So I think it is also essential to add not only contact point with the control authorities, it's very the point of contact with the holders or the data owners. And so the department responsible for the company to manage to answer all the queries, then most of them don't get to the control authority because most of them get to the control authority because the companies cannot give a timely answer. So what are the professional qualities? According to the regulation says a special knowledge on legislation and data practices. And so what does a DPO do every day? Well, first of all, the first challenge is to know the organization well. That is, it's very important for the person responsible for this area to know the departments, what are the departments that actually exist, what is the company's business, what are the data collected to make an evaluation of what is done within the company. For example, the data that are processed, the objectives, the times that their storage, whether they're necessary or not, who's got access to this, and then organize it. We have to look in-house, and then we start to organize all the data that are gathered in accordance with the different systems. Human resource selection of personnel, for example, you have to look and see what the company has is in-house, then look outside to its customers, marketing, for example, the relations, etc. And so we, first of all, have to look in-house and then outside. So the second challenge, and I think this is very important for any company, is awareness. I am normally working in companies that are more than aware of the importance of personal data. And if the example is given in at the top level of the company, and then hierarchically those principles will work all their way down. And so it's this, a requirement that is implemented in terms of systems. Following this, to work actively with the department in order to articulate the business interests. In terms of questions of privacy, my experience has shown that they don't always coincide, so the person has to sit down, think about the best possible alternative in order to jeopardise the business in any way, but to make sure that the data privacy and protection is also safeguarded. We have to clear up doubts for the workers, so as they know what the importance of the privacy of personal data. And the third, which is the greatest challenge for the DPO, is to implement all this in terms of systems from the design by default and the impact assessments. And so if everything is seen, if everybody's aware of the business, if they understood that they understand, the organisation has understood and it's aware of what's going on, then it is very easy to launch products and projects by default and in their origin and to prevent problems with privacy. And this requires the involvement of all structures, the top and bottom, and this the risks will be, there will be fewer. I say fewer risks because of this, because my experience shows that there is nothing worse than a subsequent development. I mean, this is for companies that are launching products at the moment. We have to look behind and calculate what actually exists. And so if this is done by default, then the impact assessments on the data processing will flow relatively smoothly. And so I'm not going to go on much longer on assessment impact because they've already been mentioned by the previous speaker. And thank you very much. So we don't, now I can move on to the challenges for the regulation. And so those responsible for the data controller or the DPO. So the right to oblivion or the right to deletion. I think, for example, you have to classify the type of data and to have a classification policy for the data in the company to know exactly what data is necessary and what are accessory and what I can delete, eliminate, are those that I have to keep without causing any problems. And so we have to and all of this is more complicated when I have processes and I have to notify third parties that I have this right to delete the data. And regardless of the responsibility that the processor may have in this area, what is true is that it's always be the controller will be the faulty party and not the processor. Another challenge that I'd like to call your attention to is the data bridges and breaches. This has existed electronically. They require a very short period of notification, that is 24 hours, and this obligation is now applicable to all areas in the company, and there are notifications of breach of personal data in a maximum deadline of 72 hours. So we have all these notifications that is processors accountable to the controllers and the controllers accountable to the data holders. And this causes a problem for the DPOs, which is the self-incrimination of the company. Is, for example, I have a personal data breach, and then I go to the control authority and say, look, I have a problem, so please, I want to pay the fine. I don't know how this is managed, but the other thing is the 72-hour deadline. I mean, it's still quite short. I mean, we have cases of personal data breach. For example, the first thing that has to be done by a company is to bridge the gap. For example, to make all the effort in order to bridge the gap. And so that is, we're not talking about the company or notifying the control authority. What is, we're putting an end to a situation that is existing at that moment. with the data holders. When we talk about data breaches, there are many other problems that appear. And so these are the ambiguous concepts which this norms. For example, notifying the competent authorities. No unjustified delay. That has to be clarified. What does that mean? And this, under what circumstances should there be notification? All of them? Or is it going to question the credibility of the company vis-à-vis the consumer? And so there's a risk for rights and the freedoms of the holders. And so are we going to notify the control authority or the holder? And so we must disclose this. And what's at stake is the credibility of the company and the expectations of consumers. And all companies are going to build in their own organization a whole system of incident management, so that is, that can manage to find a drop into safety and then take measures to clear things up, and then they notify the control authority or the holder of the data. Finally, and so talking about the fines which can total millions of euros, 4% of the turnover, annual yearly turnover, which is going to bear a great deal of pressure on the data controller and the DPOs, who are going to have to control all the provisions in the regulation and the whole organization. And once again, I'd like to call your attention to the fact that awareness is going to prevent non-conformity with the document. The DPO is a guarantor, but cannot look at the areas all the time to see what type of processes they're doing. No, the areas have to be aware. They have to actually ask the DPO whether they can or not do this or not do that. Another one of the major challenges that emerges with this regulation is the provision of compensation for moral damage and not only material damage. And so what I think is going to promote these... I can see that a number of holders of rights are going to get together to require compensations for moral damage and to the data controller, and they have to justify that such a factor did not result in moral damage because the whole regulation is focusing on the holder of the data. And so I think that the role of the DPO is to remind the data controller regulation is to protect people, and people remember, companies must remember this, and the data do not belong to the companies. No, they belong to the subjects and the data subjects. Thank you very much.
Muito obrigado. Vamos passar a ouvir agora o Pedro Dias.
Thank you very much. Now I pass the floor to Mr. Pedro Dias Vicente. Good afternoon. I would like to congratulate CNPD and APDSI for having organized this event, and also thank the organizers for inviting me to come here and talk to you a little bit about this. I'd like to start off by giving you an overview of EDP and what we're doing and the 2 years that we have to adapt to this new regulation. And I'd like to talk about the main challenges for EDP an EDP group, and what are the opportunities also which the GDPR presents, and how we are going to adapt and implement this new regulation. What are the main challenges then for EDP? Well, we classified them and subdivided them into several categories. First of all, in terms of inventory, personal data processing, and what levels of processing are conducted within EDP, the inventory of platforms which don't support data processing, access to personal data, and as we mentioned this morning, also the processors and sub-processors who work with us and for us. In terms of processes, the alterations and the changes will obviously involve adapting and changing equally in order to comply with the new requirements. Then people, we can't do anything without people, and the awareness required of everyone in terms of the seriousness of privacy and data protection, and then uncertainty which comes from, let's say, the grey areas. I'm not a jurist or a legal expert, but this means matters which still need to be regulated. Now, talking to you a little bit about EDP. EDP is in four different continents, 14 countries, more than 30 nationalities, a truly multinational company. So more than 10 companies are part of our group, more than 12,000 staff or employees, 9.7 million clients. So we're talking about a huge, huge amount of data. And this raises an important challenge for us. And one of the first steps that we need to give is to systematize and be able to organize this wide array of information. In terms of our processes, we have to review and revise processes which are being used. So the regulation, on the one hand, creates new obligations and reinforces the rights of data subjects. So we have to make sure that we are meeting and complying with the requirements. Also, structure the data to ensure the right to access, the right of deletion, right of limitation, processing, and the right of portability, meaning and referring to transfer between countries. Finally, it's also fundamental, and what we already have in our organization is the definition of responsibilities and who are the main actors involved in dealing with data processing. As Patricia was saying, it's important that there is strong coordination between the different areas promoting data protection and these compliance areas, and the DPO who has to ensure compliance. So appointing a DPO is important. Is it mandatory or not? Does it have to be an internal DPO or an external one? Can it be one for the entire group? Does it have to be one per geography where we, in which we are represented? These are questions. Then we have to implement the different processes which will prevent the breaches, and also the performing the DPIAs and the PIAs. We have to fine-tune the circumstances which will warrant the DPIAs to be carried out. So what are the main challenges? This has to come from the top. So it's a top-down approach so that it reaches all of the different layers within our organization, which is fundamental. Then train people properly about what they can do and can't do, inform them, raise awareness in terms of what may happen, what are the risks. We are all people, we all have our individual characteristics, so we have to be able to put ourselves in the position of others in order to understand how it has an impact. So this involves not only internal but external stuff. Finally, concerning our uncertainties or main uncertainties, these are the questions relating to to processing subject to DPIAs, for instance, or PIAs. Also, the mandatory nature of a DPO, whether we call the person a DPO or something else, it's important that someone is qualified in order to carry out this task within the company. And then we have specifications and derogations in terms of the data subject rights. But life is not just made up of challenges, but also opportunities, and we have to ensure the rights of data subjects. And this in itself may mean providing a differentiated service, and it may be a differentiating advantage. It can make a difference amongst our clients. It may attract new clients who are especially concerned with this issue. We cannot look at this as something which is a hindrance to our business. Quite to the contrary, it's a competitive advantage. And this is the kind of view we have on the matter. And in working with everyone to this end, we want to have yet an additional differentiating factor, something which gives us an extra edge within the business. So what have we set up so far in order to comply with the obligations? So our model is based on three main traditional pillars. On the one hand, prevention, then detection and correction or response. In prevention, we have a data government model which manages all our company details and data. We have a security information security policy and classified information. We have access management, access profiles, confidentiality clauses. All of this was in existence but prior to the regulation and will have to be adjusted to the new regulation. In detection, we have implemented validation and revision mechanisms. Also, monitoring, auditing, response-wise, and our actions in terms of correction, corrective measures or response. We have a close follow-up of all incidences and improvement action plans. So what next? What can be done and what are the future steps in order to better implement and adopt the European regulation, which will change in such an impacting way our organizations? First of all, we need to get to know it properly. What are the obligations, requirements under this new GDPR? And looking at the organization, what are the assets? What's the personal, what are the personal data we have? Detailed risk analysis. Also, identify those who and the information which requires more careful handling and processing. We also have to understand, and that's part of the impact assessment, how we are actually managing these existing processes, what control and security mechanisms are in place, which allows us to analyze where we are, where we would like to be, and to reinforce our compliance model and match it with the requirements stemming from this regulation. This is what we intend to do over the next year and a half in order to fully implement and adopt the European regulation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So now we can move on to the last speaker of our panel, Eugenia Santos. Good afternoon, everybody. First of all, I would like to congratulate the organization for having organized this conference for us from the public sector. It is increasingly more important to talk about these topics. And since May, I am at the board of the Edge Agency for Administrative Modernization. So up to now, I wasn't too concerned about these matters. But now with the presentations that I've just heard, I was a little bit worried about what I'm going to say because it runs the risk of being repetitive. When we're asked to talk about the impacts of data on the regulation, then we always have a certain difficulty in extracting that which is specific to public administration, because most of the norms apply to both sectors, public and private. And so when I was preparing this presentation, I tried to find something innovative, or something I'd like to call attention to the colleagues and to take into account in the future. The first presentation was about the impact assessment and data protection, and here I'm not going to repeating this, I would just like to say the public administration, especially major big authorities, big departments that process a greater number of data, especially those that do mass processing of data, should start now preparing themselves, because we don't have much time in this legal diploma. Entered into force in May 2018, and up to now, public administration will have to prepare itself technically. It will have to give training to its staff, especially those who are processing data, and on the other hand, will have to prepare itself from the organizational point of view. It's going to have to ask itself what it has to do within the organization in order to guarantee that these assessments, whenever they have got to do with personal data, how the organization is going to work. Well, I prepared this slide. I would just like to call your attention to the fact that the security levels can be done through data. And we received the data necessary for the processing. We can have a system that will guarantee confidentiality, availability of the system, and finally, to prepare for a process that can be regularly assessing the measures it adopted. So, if you look at the authorities that have been processing these data over the last 2 years in public administration, I could say that we have not had any major problems with confidentiality or integrity. But I would also like to talk to you about a new figure that appears for public administration and that Patricia has already developed in detail, that is the DPO. And here I would like to call your attention to public administration. It can be a member of staff responsible for processing, or it can be an outsider, but it has to be somebody with specialized knowledge in the area. And here I'd very like to go over the competences very quickly. So what do I expect from the DPO? That he advises me, that he guarantees that all the processing that is done in-house on personal data, it will tell me how I have to do it, because I'm not a specialist. And, so for example, would be the contact point for the control authorities and the citizen. I'd like to recall that the name of this person has to be published, and the contact has to be available. Having said that, we in public administration, I think there is a paradigm shift. Now, what has happened up to now? Up to now, when we were processing data in the past, and when we wanted to collect the data and process it, we would ask the commission whether we could do and what could we do. Now, that's not the case. In most cases, we don't have to do this. We don't have to ask for this authorization. Why? Because this responsibility is now, well, this is what I understood, this responsibility is now in the hands of the DPO. And like everything else in life, with we have more autonomy, we have more responsibility. And I'd like to highlight what Patricia said, that the officer will have to be very careful in verifying the requirements, to make sure that the requirements are all complied with and not, and then so to make sure that the control authority doesn't turn up and to compares for example, what the Court of Auditors would do. And so, for example, if somebody is sent to the Court of Auditors, and when a contract is not sent to the Court of Auditors, I am subject to successive auditing. I'm not so calm, because we never know when we made a little mistake. So this increased responsibility is one of the aspects of public administration should bear in mind in the future. Finally, I'd like to call your attention to the fact that in the compliance requirements of all the legal, that is all legal requirements, we mustn't forget the main rights that the data subject has. And that is all the rights that are set out in the regulation. We have to take into account that if there's a right, there's a duty. So it's a true sort of list of specifications. Here I can give you the right, for example, an example, the right to transparency, communications, rules. So this is a right that means that the public administrations use clear language and that can be understood by all. The same applies to the right to deletion. I'm not going to go into this because the next panel is actually about the citizens' rights, but I'd like to call your attention to these two rights, which I think are innovative. I mean, there was more or less established, but they are now clearly identified. That is the right to a deletion of data in specific situations. I believe the lady said that is when the aim for which they were collected comes to an end, and the right to receive and convey the data in a structured manner through models. So it's a public administration in a specific case. We already do this, says the lady. So one of the AMA's concern is to make sure that all the systems within public interest are interoperable to allow for this transferability of the data between the different institutions. So I think that's all I have to say. And as the speakers before me have developed this, this topic very well indeed. Thank you very much.
Muito obrigado. Temos,
Thank you very much. We have roughly half an hour now. We're slightly delayed, but not a lot. This panel was about the impact on organizations of the new GDPR and the new responsibilities that these organizations now have. So I'm sure that there are lots of questions. It's a very practical topic. I think there's a question. Just a few requests beforehand. Please be straight to the point. Not just questions. You're allowed to make comments, criticism, but just be straight to the point and address a question at just one member of the panel, not to all, because that would be the equivalent of four questions. So the first gentleman I saw was the one at the front here, but maybe someone else had also asked for the floor. So, okay, so if you will. Okay, my name is João Vaz de Paula. A good thing I only have one question for one speaker. So my question, okay, so you comply with the requirements, fine. Yes, well, it's been mentioned, and this is for EDP, that the new meters being installed are privacy intrusive because through the new consumption profiles and measurements that you can extrapolate from this information what times of day people are at home, etc. That's a very specific area within EDP with the readings, be it manual or automatic. That information exists already. The question is what to do with that information and whether that the readings are used for some illicit or unlawful intent. Well, the new automatic readings are not smart readings, are they? Yes, well, they are smart readings in the sense that they record the consumptions when they take place. Once more, this information is collected, and the question is, what's going to be done with this information? As far as I know, no abusive use of that information is taking place. As was mentioned, the answer was given by the representative from EDP, but Mr. David Wright would also like to say something.
I think this is a very interesting question, and the way this was dealt with in the UK, following some very bad examples of the implementation, forced implementation of smart meters, was that they carried out a data protection impact assessment by the government and by the Energy Suppliers Association, by industry, and they consulted a lot of stakeholders, and they went out of their way to consult with different types of stakeholders, a wide range of stakeholders. So in the case of the UK, there has been no opposition to the installation of smart meters, unlike some other countries, as a result of that?
Eu vou abusar de uma prerrogativa do moderador e vou fazer uma pergunta de follow-up.
I will also pick up on this with a follow-up question for Pedro Dias Vicente also, and this has to do with the right of deletion. The right of deletion seems to be an exclusive right for data subjects, but that information has to do with privileged company information as well. It has to do with their business. So if an EDP customer demands all the individual data to be erased in terms of how much an individual has consumed, at what times, can this be done? Or does EDP consider that to be operational data, so we're not talking about personal data? Well, once more, that's a very specific question. And once more, I'm not a legal expert, so I hope I won't make a mistake in my comments. But I do believe that regardless of whether the data is being collected via manual readings or automatic readings through the smart meters, these are important readings in order to provide the service that EDP provides as a supplier or a distribution operator, because it distributes to the various suppliers. And without that information, suppliers would not be able to maintain their relationship with their clients. Obviously, there has to be informed consent by the client, in the sense that the client is aware that that information is going to be used by these various suppliers. I would like to add, and what Peter's saying, and it's a fact, and I don't know EDP's reality, so I'm going to talk about this and comment on this in a more abstract way. But when EDP collects this data, which may be considered profile data, if nothing is extracted or extrapolated from that data, it's not considered critical. And if a data subject requests the right of deletion, there are legal obligations that a company still has to comply with and fulfill. So there are contract and legal obligations when the data is no longer required for the service at stake and invoicing, then the companies should have data deletion mechanisms set up. So it's the data cycle. It has to be designed in a way that once they are no longer necessary, they can be erased. I'm Luis Antunes from the University of Porto. I'd like to make a comment to David Wright, which the other speakers may comment on. My question is, in terms of the privacy impact assessment, we have a very important aspect to take into consideration, which is risk assessment, and to do with profiling. My question is whether this is done in-house by the company itself, or is it something that should be done by outsourcing? And that was a question. Now, just a comment. This morning I said I had more doubts than certainties vis-a-vis the new regulation. Now I have yet another certainty that this impacts public and private. But what we have seen and heard here, heard from the other three speakers, that now we are have ahead of us the wonderful world of new data, and that there was nothing in the past. My question is everything being notified, all of the data collected being notified? Has there been an assessment, a risk assessment conducted? It seems that we have a new wonderful world of data ahead of us, but what about the world that we've had so far? How is that going to be taken into account?
To respond to your specific question about who should do the data protection impact assessment, or PIA, I have to say I prefer the term PIA, Privacy Impact Assessment, compared to Data Protection Impact Assessment, because data protection, in my view, is just one type of privacy, and I think a PIA should cover all types. But anyway, you know, when I started researching the area of privacy impact assessment several years ago, and I've written a lot of stuff on PIA and produced the first and only book, as far as I know, on PIA, I've studied it a lot. When I started, I believed it was better for an organization to conduct its own privacy impact assessment. The reason is that they would gain experience and they would be able to benefit from the every single PIA they do. They would benefit, the next one they would benefit from. So, you know, I think there's a learning experience that's good for the organization. Trilateral, my company, has conducted PIAs for various organizations, and I've come around 180 degrees the other way, where I now believe it's better to have somebody outside do the PIA just for reasons of credibility, like the ones that I mentioned that were done by the UK government and by the Energy Suppliers Association in the UK. They had external consultants do those PIAs, and I think that gives them more credibility.
Obrigado. Temos mais, se quiserem fazer algo.
Any further questions or comments? Up the top, please. Danielle Reis, lawyer. I have a question for Elena Sench. According to the regulation, the member states will decide whether the fines are also applicable to public entities. I'd like to hear your opinion about what the Portuguese legislator is going to do in this respect. That's a very easy answer because, as you said, you're asking me a question which I am not able to answer. The legislator will have to do that. But there are aspects within the regulation, according to what I read, that the legislator will have to work on over the course of these 2 years. And it has already been mentioned that there are many concepts, various vague, undetermined concepts, which the legislator will have to specify in terms of what has to be brought to the committee, what's going to be deemed as risk or high risk. Under this regulation, the member states and the authorities can create a list with all of the circumstances in which prior consultation to the authorities is mandatory. So there's a lot to be done. I'm not the legislator, so I don't feel that I have the experience or the knowledge to answer your question. I'd also just like to add that prior to the regulation being published, there was already a lot in terms of data protection. And from the very onset, the committee has a say in the matter. When we address the issue of data protection, we look at not only the importance of the data, we notify the committee, or we ask for prior authorization from our national authority. And I have absolutely no doubts whether the national authority analyzes the risk involved in the specific data. So I don't think that we are just erasing the past mistakes or the past circumstances and moving into this bright new world just like that. I think we have another question. Good afternoon. My question is could you please, if I may, ask you to introduce yourself? My name is Rui Pereira. I work for the Shared Information Services in Public Administration, and my question is for Eugenia Sench. I trained in computer studies and computer sciences, and over the years, what I've realized is that the security component has been the poor relative of these areas of protection. And my question, or my suggestion, is that within the scope of the decisions under the responsible bodies and all of the actions which have been outlined for this year and the next, whether it shouldn't be the responsible authority to actually be more aware of this and more sensitive to this, because it has been always it has always been neglected in terms of its own data protection. Yes, well, I think that this is going to be dealt with differently. We have the CETIC, the General Council for ICTs, which has been set up, which is directly under the Prime Minister, and very recently our own minister has become in charge of this. All stakeholders are present. They will have to submit a global action plan for ICTs in terms of safety and processing, and I have absolutely no doubts that once this regulation is enforced, that this committee will take into account this data protection aspect and issue, and I have absolutely no doubt. And it will be through the plan, this plan, that the government will be made more aware of these issues. If I may, I'd like to add, and very much like any company at a public administration level, awareness has to come from the top. Otherwise, there'll be no company whatsoever implementing in its systems any safeguards in terms of privacy. I do not come from an equivalent reality, and I was surprised to hear that the safety component is the poor relative. That surprises me, because I can't protect data without the safety factor. That's out of the question. So any activity, any advice I may give in terms of data protection always has backing it some sort of safety information and safety component. More questions? Comments? Criticism? Concerns, fears. We are broadening the spectrum to see if we get more feedback from the audience. Good afternoon. My name is Gabriela Andrade. I'd like to ask, under what circumstances does a private company have to appoint a DPO? I think this is probably for Patricia. The regulation imposes that the DPO be appointed when we're talking about a public entity or body. When we're talking about private businesses, when we are dealing with companies which have a constant need for collecting and processing personal information and potentially sensitive information. There have been some alterations as to the wording of those companies which have an obligation to appoint a DPO. It's not necessarily due to or relating to the specific size of a company, but the kind of information dealt with on a systematic basis. And that's some of the. These are some of the differences. Well, my question. My name is Nadia Costa. Sorry, I had a doubt about that expression consists, and in English it's the exact same expression. It's not clear, however, for me what the word consists of. It's not clear for me when you're talking about processing. If we use, for instance, as an example, Mayo, which processes thousands and thousands of different personal data a day, I think that for all EDPs and mails, what is the consists of? I don't think there's an answer, but I'd also like to hear your opinion on what you think this concept will be about, in actual fact. For me, it involves and consists of I collect data, store data, be it in Mayo or any other company, and then I'm going to process this information, use it for other purposes. So I need the clients, consumers, information to do my, to conduct my business, but I'm also going to then have to treat that information, process it in a given way. If I may add, that doubt has also been raised within EDP, because EDP's job is not to process personal data, but to provide a service, to provide electricity. But I agree, the data collected and processed may be subject to additional processing. But I think that the borders aren't very clear, the limits aren't clear. I don't know whether we will be forced to appoint a DPO, although I personally think that we should. David Wright, would you like to add anything to this?
Yes, please. Well, the GDPR says what processing comprises, and just simply collecting personal data is processing. Processing includes the collection, the storage, the treatment of the data, how you delete it, what you do with it. It includes everything from the beginning of the cycle to the end of the cycle.
Obrigado. Mais alguma pergunta?
Thank you very much. Any other questions? There are no raised hands, so I will ask a question. And the question is to David Wright. And it's the following. In Portugal, one of the major alterations introduced by this new European data protection regulation is that we are coming to an end of an era of something which we had before, which was prior notification of the creation of a personal database. With this new regulation, organizations don't have to issue this prior notification, but just have to conduct these impact assessments. And I'd like to ask you whether, in your opinion, this is more protective of data subjects, the citizens, than the notification and prior authorization?
It's a very good question. And I think it's not a simple question to answer. I mean, previously, notification was just that. You tell the data protection authority that you are creating a database, full stop. We have notified in the UK, we've identified the, we've notified the Information Commissioner's Office that we were compiling a database of personal data, and there has never been any kind of follow-up. So, and I think that's typically the case. Usually notification was just that. You tell the data protection authority that you're creating a database, nothing more. I think in a way the data protection impact assessment or privacy impact assessment is better because you are hopefully engaging stakeholders, including data subjects. So you're looking at how you're using personal data in a more detailed way than occurred when you were doing just simply a notification. So I think that's better. However, from the many data protection impact assessments or privacy impact assessments that I've looked at over the last several years, I would say 90% of them are of a poor quality, are not very good. Maybe 10% are very good. Where is the problem? I think the problem, the improvement of privacy impact assessments would come if data protection authorities did a sample. Maybe they check 3% or 5% of the privacy impact assessments that are done. And I think if they If they did that, over time, the quality of privacy impact assessments would go up. The second way of improving the quality is to publish the privacy impact assessment or a summary of the privacy impact assessment on the organization's website. That's not always possible.
But that's not mandatory.
It's not mandatory, and it's not always...
In your opinion, should it be mandatory?
Well, I think it would be a good practice to do that. I think it's not possible to make it mandatory because some privacy impact assessments deal with sensitive commercial information or sensitive security information. So I think in those two cases, it's not really possible to do it. But even so, I think there's ways of dealing with that, and that is, for example, you could have a group of stakeholders who who sign a non-disclosure agreement so that they act as a kind of independent advisor as to the quality of that privacy impact assessment. So I think there's solutions.
Mais alguma pergunta?
Any questions? If not, then I will try and ask some more questions.
Dois representantes das empresas e da administração pública, uma resposta muito breve. Acham que estes PIAs ou...
Whether PIAs should be public or should there be some way of publishing them or not? Can they, should they, what? Please, a very brief answer, because we're already late.
Patricia, quer começar?
Patricia, do you want to publish? No. Well, I hadn't actually thought about it, but this is a procedure which is normal for some companies. I think that they could only or should be published if there is a harmonization or a standard that would allow a company to supplement this with information. On the contrary, the way an impact assessment is made today, there's an awful lot of information, but it's in-house information, so it can't belong to the company, it can't be published. Whether either there's a standard with clear rules by the authorities in terms of what this assessment is and what information should exist in it. If not, then when a company is going to make an impact assessment, is going to publish information which is actually confidential. Does it belong to the company? I think the citizens will have the same concern about their own information because it's theirs. That's what I was going to say. As long as we don't question the confidentiality of the data, I'm talking as a citizen, I would like to have knowledge of the assessment that was actually made so as I know exactly what risks exist and to have the freedom to give my opinion on it. Thank you. Thank you. Now I've got the most important thing than publishing. The PIA is to involve stakeholders. This is very important. And then to publishing. What do you mean by publishing? So how much is published or is it used as an instrument that will just make the company worried about the confidentiality? So David Wright said... Well, because for all purposes it's possible to be audited, and so whether they're public or not, they have to be consulted. Consulted by the authorities, of course. David?
Just briefly, it's interesting to note that U.S. government agencies publish their PIAs on their website. So if you go to the U.S. State Department or the FBI... or any other agency of the U.S. government, you can find the PIAs that they carry out. They're published on their website. They're all grouped together. The Canadian government also does something similar, but they publish only summaries.
OK. Ok, muito obrigado.
Thank you very much.
Levantado, estamos 6 minutos para além da...
We're 6 minutes late, which is very Portuguese punctuality. Punctuality was not invented in Switzerland, but anyway, I would like to thank the members of the panel and the public. Thank you very much.
Muito boa tarde. Penso que já estamos todos organizados.
Good afternoon. Now we're moving on to the last panel. So I would like to say that my name is Fatima Kessadur. I'm a journalist, and it's a great pleasure for me to be here and to try and chair this panel for a very very challenging topic. Sorry. And so on the impact on citizens and supervision. And so it's great to see so many people interested in this topic, and to see that people want to know what the impacts are and how can one prepare oneself, and the way citizens can manage the protection of their data and to know what their rights are in terms of data protection. And so I'm here with a panel of specialists who will be able to explain their views on the new regulation and answer a number of questions that there may be. So I think we can start with the session. And so I'd like to introduce the people, although the previews are on the agenda. I have Catarina Sarmenti Castro, who belongs as a judge in the Constitutional Court. She has a great deal of experience. She was a member of the Data Protection Committee. And she's got Esther Massé, who's a senior analyst in the ONG Access Now. And Alexandre Sousa Pinheiro, his professor of law at the University of Lisbon and belongs to the Data Protection Board, who's going to be the first speaker. Well, we are going to follow the model, like in the other panels, that is 15 minutes each. You will be able to talk, and then there'll be the Q&A, okay? And for those who want to have want to the translation, they know that there is an interpreter. And I think that Estelle, you're going to speak in English, right? Yeah. And so we're going to start the session. If Alexandre Souza Pinheiro is ready.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My initial words are words of thanks to the National Data Protection Board and the PDSI for the invitation to be here in this initiative, which is fundamental for us to be able to understand the new legal regime that will come into force very soon in the area of data protection and privacy in the European area. And when I say the European area, given the flow of international traffic, we're talking globally. And I will talk today about the topic of the control authority in the Portuguese case as a national data protection committee, but it is the control authorities that is set out in the regulation. But before this, I would like to say two things. One has got to do with a doubt that emerged in the last panel. Just one thing to give you my interpretation, and I think that is the best way to assess the situation. We have a specific article, and I will my presentation will be based on the regulation and the data protection law. And one of the questions that was asked has got to do with Article 37, number 1, subparagraph B of the regulation, and to the express consistent says that the main activities of the data controller or the processor consists in data processing operations. What is the doubt here? Well, note, when you say that the activity consists in data processing, the main point here is to know whether we're talking when there is data processing or not, because a hospital doesn't exist to treat data. It's there to treat patients, but it also treats data, so a hospital cannot be considered outside the scope of this regulation. And so when we have the expression consist in, it doesn't exclude the application of any activity where there is a treatment of personal information or processing of personal information. And so the concept that exists in the directive continues to exist here. The basic concepts exist in the directive, and even the concept of personal data, which has somewhat changed, but slightly, goes from the directive to the regulation. So basically, as regards the concepts, everything is here. So the question of the process that was talked about this morning by Minx Ferinho, this has developed more greater detail, and says the economic activity that results from this figure that hasn't been properly defined in the directive yet. And so this is just a very brief clarification on a very obvious topic. Now, as to the regulation, one of the aspects is the following. The regulation wanted to apply more stable law in the European Union, meaning that we have a common law in terms of data protection in the EU and not a directive that is transposed differently in different member states. So we should say that the regulation recognizes its shortcomings. So when we find, for example, to give you an example, when we find Article 88 of the regulation, and so this is a very important article given that this is going to raise difficulties in everyday life for companies and public administration, when it says that the processing of data in labour contracts, it is, refers to this, that the states may establish more specific norms, and note that the legal imprecision that this had, more specific means that they can establish a legal regime which will be different from one member state from another. In the case of labour law, so an area that was difficult to treat and regards personal data, which that is the area of labour law, and clearly it says here that there is a sort of collapse of the possibility of an understanding between member states and the regulation. The same we can find in Article 6, in the last paragraph of Article 6 regarding health data. Now note that so the expression that is used here is sensitive. So it's very difficult to come to an understanding here, both in Article 6 and in the provision I mentioned. We have the regulation saying that the member states may issue legislation, specific legislation. And so this is one of the important elements for us to understand that this regulation is not, nor can it be, the only instrument on data protection. In other words, resulting from this regulation, there is a need for internal legislation on data protection. I think it's obvious that the states can do this. And states will do this. Now, as regards the profile of the control authorities in the Portuguese case, National Data Protection Board, we also have a new regulation. In the new regulation, a reference to the different powers of these entities. First of all, what is the major principle in the regulation that was also in the directive? Independence. So the major principle is independence. Now these entities should be independent. And here we can find this in the text and in the recitals of this text. Now, within the text, relevant expression is Article 58, which points out powers, research powers, correction powers, and consultative powers or authoritative powers. Now, it's very important that what we find today in the Data Protection Law 6698 prevails for the future scope of this regulation, given that if we look at the powers that the National Data Protection Board, in line with other, in comparison with other control authorities in Europe, then this is probably that one that has got a more developed number of powers of research. Now therefore, when we find in the regulation, in Article 58.1, subparagraph F, in order to have access to all installations of the data controller and processor, including equipment and means of processing, note that this is a power of prospective nature that has to be set out by law. And at the moment, the National Data Protection Board. It's referred to the National Data Protection Board, but it should refer to same entity with other powers. Now, we have a data protection law that was issued by way of the transposition of a community directive. Now, when the regulation comes into force, what is going to exist? Well, there will be the validity of the regulation over the directive. The directive will no longer be of interest, and so that means does that mean that the internal law will no longer be valid? No, the internal law will only prevail in situations that are in no way in opposition to the provisions in the regulation. Now, as regards these matters that have got to do with the powers and the powers of the control authority, so during the period from now until May, there should be new legislation, so there's no doubt in relation to what the future of the Portuguese Control Authority will be. When I say Portuguese, I'm talking about the others, because we're talking about the regulation. Now, we have a model, a supervisory model, that has changed. It will be changed, based on a posteriori control model and not prior control, even though in Article 35 there still is subject matter subject to prior control. This is 35.4, and the matter regarding to the DPO set out in Article 37. So it will be important that the legislator, national legislator, defines in what terms the institutional framework of the Data Protection Authority will be built, and also of the new powers of the Commission, it should be set out by law. Now, one of the problems that we had throughout these panels, and we'll hear about this in the future, has got to do with the vague concept. Some of them may be set out by law, so therefore cleared up. Others will need an administrative intervention. Those vague concepts are necessary to ensure that law may evolve and will not be attached to a reality that was true one day, but the next day is not. It's always changing. So the protection of personal data is very important for us to take into account that reality transforms, changes. And so in that way, we have to find in legislation, and here there are some vague aspects or concepts that are absolutely necessary, so as we can always apply the norm. Another aspect I would like to mention is the following. We have the idea that EU law prevails over national law, and including the right constitutional law. Well, this has to be interpreted very, very carefully. Because when we have norms on fundamental rights and there is EU legislation that may question the fundamental rights that exist in member states' constitutions, even though we have the charter, well, I don't understand why there's no control of constitutionality. The Germans have already thought about this in terms of fundamental rights by establishing rules to ensure there's a control of constitutionality beforehand when we are faced with norms on fundamental rights. Now, this is important when we are faced with this, and this morning we spoke about this, in terms of the data breaches. We spoke about the need to inform the control authority of a data protection breach, and the question that is asked is, doesn't this collide with constitutional principles, including the principle of non-discrimination? Now, this has to be discussed within national law, because when we're talking about these topics, we cannot forget the constitutional framework of the member states and the, in the specific case, the Portuguese constitutional framework. Now, we can't have a schematic form of applying EU law, but in terms of thinking that EU law prevails over national law. No. There's lots of people that learned that was the case, but this is not the way it is. But it has to... We have to think about the compatibility of norms, the compatibility between these norms and fundamental rights. And so we had this regulation, but we had two directives on safety and being on name reference. And so we have to take this into account as regards the compatibility of the regulation with constitutional norms. Now, if you look today, Law 6788, I believe the gentleman said, that is the data protection law, we find powers that are attributed to the Data Protection Commission and are not attributed to other bodies, that are of an independent nature under the terms of Article 22, number 3 of Law 6798. It says that the Commission has powers of authority, namely to order the blockage, not payment of data protection. And this is not common to other control authorities. I'd just like to say that national legislation is going to have to think about this topic and others that have that are on the agenda, and think that this should be this should continue. That is the issue of opinion of the National Data Protection Commission before or during legislative procedures. Now, what the law says is that the members, or the regulation says, the control authorities may pronounce, will give their opinion if you understood, but the obligation to obtain an opinion from the National Data Protection Commission is another question. But this obligation should be set out by law, and I see a great advantage to have for the law to address this topic between now and May 2018. And thank you very much.
Muito obrigada. Passamos então agora à Catarina Sarmenti Castro.
Thank you very much. Now I pass the floor to Catarina Sarmenti Castro. Thank you very much. I'd like to start by greeting my fellow members of the panel, some of whom I have known for many years now. And I'd like to start by adding to this that I am at home at home, especially when the Portuguese National Authority is the host, the CNPD, because I worked with the CNPD for many years, and it was for me a huge pleasure to accept this invitation. And I'd also like to thank the president of the APDSI. These issues are symptomatic. When we search on the internet these topics, the results that come up clearly illustrate the impact foreseen and the impact these issues have on organizations, and how this will really have an impact at various levels. And this is visible not only here in this conference in terms of the questions raised, but also the issues pertaining to the corporate sector, public administration. In many questions and issues were raised within these fields, because there's a sense that something is going to change, and in terms of what is expected of them. And this is what's visible when it comes to the private providers of goods and services in this globalized economy. These very, very many references are constant, and the internet shows us this and gives us these explanations, and this is also why we're here. But there have also been transformations, and as someone sitting at this table said, these obligations which will fall on the service providers and public services, these obligations, these citizens' rights that have to be taken into account, which were already to a great extent taken into account. But all of this is part of a lengthy negotiation process which started in 2012. And in my opinion, globally, this will all lead to a larger scope of protection for European citizens, namely via all of the examples that have already been given today. For instance, data protection in its specific aspects, privacy by design, or other measures which we intend to implement in order to ensure data protection from the technology that supports them, as well as other issues pertaining to breaches and transferring information. So we've gone into the various organizational, technical sides of the issue, and how the operators will process information. And the panel helped us to understand how these demands and requirements are fundamental to protect citizens at an informational level. These obligations, which will be the responsibility of organizations, intend to protect personal information, but also represent another side of the equation. On the other hand, regulation is focusing on a line of thought which is simplifying procedures, meaning that via this regulation, we will standardize European regulations, compensating the natural fluctuations. But I also agree with what was said by Alexandre Sousa Pinheiro when he said that there will be no doubt the need to fine-tune here and there some aspects which the regulation will not address properly. And the question is, what will happen when the directive falls, and what's in the legislation in terms of data protection, and how will the legislator resolve this? This notion of simplification also takes on a more important role when we talk about simplifying procedures. I was talking with someone from the National Commission for Data Protection about this. So what's the reason behind all of this? We are looking for a trend which doesn't just cover this area. It's a trend which we've seen generally being applied by legislation in order to achieve simplification of administrative procedures so that they are less complex, less expensive, that they are speedier, and that this also correlates with what happens in the private industry, in the private sector. So it's a sort of green light for processing data and increasing the competitive edge of businesses and cut back on red tape. Apart from this simplification for the corporate sector, for businesses, there are references as to who's in charge of trans-border information flows. Citizens have also seen a greater simplification because there is only one spokesperson now, the National Data Protection Authority. For instance, the Schrems case was mentioned this morning. The Austrian law student who wanted to complain about information being published on Facebook, but was told that he had to address the Irish National Data Protection Authority because Facebook was based in Ireland. So this tends to simplify those procedures, and this information flow between companies, authorities, which is often cross-border, all of this is taken into account so that economic and administrative activities, which are global nowadays, are easier. And if it allows for the information to circulate, if this is an objective established in the directive back in 1995, then the fact is that altering the technological, economic and social context, which we've seen since then, has brought about new challenges which this regulation aims to address. And so 21 years have gone by since the directive was approved. And 250 million people use the internet daily for social purposes, to relate or to deal with public services, to do business. And within this regulation, we also see the central axis from moving from supervision in data protection, as was mentioned by Professor Alexandre Pinheiro, and an activity which was mainly prior administrative control based or supervision based. If this prior administrative supervision or control model of data was the rule, now we are privileging post supervision, post auditing, which is of a more reactive nature. The panels have already touched upon this. There will be a follow-up in terms of informational supervision activities. Illustrating this prior transfer of personal data processing into the accountability of those who actually carry this out. The fact is that prior supervision or monitoring does not disappear. It doesn't mean that with a regulation, data processing is free of all requirements. No, as was mentioned and underlined by Professor Alexandre Sousa Pinheiro during this panel, let there be no doubts that when companies working with personal data, of which the activity in itself is not data processing, they will still covered by this regulation, and they do this under their own accountability. But this prior requirement does not disappear, and it's up to the authorities to monitor. And there is this notion of self-accountability present, which we were not necessarily used to in Europe, but it's self-accountability which has have been a consequence of the need to break down the system because of the huge amount of data, which is too much for everyone or every entity to supervise and monitor. So this trend did not aim at making data circulation free in terms of free movement of data, but to reinforce certain alternative control mechanisms. And we will see post-monitoring capabilities and mechanisms being applied. And as of this and from this, we see a lesser concern of the regulation with data processing because of this self-accountability, which is now under the responsibility of those who directly process the information. Whether this is sufficient or not, whether this it will be this independent authority will be able to operate properly in monitoring, we will see. But this is how it has been outlined and how it has been predicted and planned. There were some actual experiences abroad which showed that the legislation did not request authorization as often as the directive. So this is not necessarily something which has not been experimented before, because it has. Apart from this, the regulation also intends to strengthen citizens' rights, encompassing all of these aspects, of course, but also considered standards which look at citizen protection. And that's what I was asked to talk about, and I will make some brief references. This regulation, as mentioned, seeks to find new solutions for new concerns which stem from the growing use of ICTs, namely networking, speed of information, the mass of data, globalization enabled by these means. And over these past 21 years, a lot has changed. The other day, I heard someone explaining to a child or to a young kid that we didn't always have mobile phones, we had landlines only. And the question was, between being horrified and amazed, was that, well, how did you take photographs? Was it with your landline? Just to say that there's an entire generation which does not know any other reality whatsoever. Not forgetting, obviously, that many people may not have access to all of these mechanisms, be it amongst us or around the entire world. But we cannot forget that if this cyberspace, which for us is so much a part of our daily lives, if it should be seen today as a way forward or a place which can enhance the exercise of one's own citizenship rights. And in my views, we can actually call for a true fundamental right to access the internet. This democratization of the digital world, namely the networking digital world, be it through the informational flows which characterize it or others, this life should bring with it the necessary safeguards and a right we have to access the network, access administrative services online, to interact in digital society, broadening democratic participation through these means and accessing content-generating mechanisms. All of this implies treating personal data at various levels, and hence and therefore we have to protect our personal data. And I'm talking about operators, public administration, the private sector. And this is known, and studies have shown it, that only the trust in those who handle and process data make it possible for each of those private operators to be successful in their businesses. And this brings me to a necessary reference to the fact that what's at stake here is far more than just a violation of people's privacy through data or telecommunications. We have acknowledged, and it has been acknowledged in the European Charter of Human Rights Constitution, a fundamental right is the fundamental right to data protection. And this fundamental right to data protection, which exists since the original constitutional article, which is 40 years old, with another focus, nevertheless, but this brings me to two concrete circumstances. And just to conclude, within the different rights enshrined, there's one which is an innovation vis-a-vis the directive, portability of rights, and also the right for deletion or to be forgotten. I think that the first is more a consumer's right. The ability to transfer iTunes list of musics to competition, meaning that those who may react to regulations and those who did react to the alterations to the regulations were the economic operators, not the consumers, drawing and calling your attention to the interoperationality and interoperability costs. Obviously, when this has an impact on apps produced by small companies, it may at first be somewhat limiting. In public administration, the rule is that of interoperability, and someone was here earlier saying that, meaning that in order to allow for our circulating data, which is in public administration, for as a result of public interest, or because it's required, the interoperability means that we don't have to constantly be providing our personal information in public administration. Just to conclude, just a reference to the right to be forgotten. This reinforces the pre-existing right to be forgotten, such as erasing data which is no longer necessary or which is excessive for the purpose at stake. And the reinforcement has to do with the fact that the right to be left alone, quoting an article, that this is only effective if the data subject is given assurances that the information will be erased as soon as possible without unjustifiable delay, and if that's his or her wish, which has happened in a case where the European Court of Justice recognized the inexistence of such a right because of the indexed results of search engines of the links which were shown up by the search engine and addressed and forwarded him to the newspaper which listed the assets that had been seized from him, and sided by him in his position to complain about this. We should not forget that not only this, but the right to the curiosity over one's own data, right to information, updating, correction, limitation, the right to be opposed to, and the right to not be subject to an individual automated decision, which may be of little use because few have the available algorithms to do so or had so in the past. But now, in my opinion, this will be one of the rights which may, in my opinion, become more important given the ability and how easy it is to set up profiles and to automate so many things in our life. Thank you very much.
Muito obrigada.
Thank you very much. You mentioned a number of points that are very relevant, and I took note of a number of words which are very significant, like trust. And so we're looking at the regulation from the point of view of companies that are preparing themselves to comply with the rules. But then, of course, there's a point of view of the citizen and their rights and the way companies can help them protect this data that belong to the citizen and not the companies that has already been mentioned here before. So let's move on to Estelle Masik, who is going to give a presentation in English, and she's got a PowerPoint that is also going to be shown here in the projector. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let me start by thanking the CNPD and the AP and DSI for the invitation today and for this great event. I'm here to represent AccessNow, the organization for which I work for as a senior policy analyst, which is an international NGO that works to defend and extend the digital rights of users at risk around the world, and EDRI, which is the European Digital Rights organization that is based in Brussels and represents more than 30 civil liberties NGOs around Europe, which includes AccessNow. So today, I'll be speaking on the issue of the rights for users in the GDPR and also how this will be completed by the new enforcement mechanism that is put into place. So I'll not enter into detail into the consistency mechanism that has been presented this morning, but just showing you a couple of elements that are in the GDPR and are new elements that would mutually reinforce the rights that have been in place since the 95 directive and reinforce the enforcement mechanism. So, first of all, before doing so, I want to go back to what is the GDPR and what is the focus of the GDPR. So the GDPR aims to put users back in control of their personal information and empower them to use their data. At the beginning of this thinking, we have the two rights of data protection and privacy, which are both enshrined in the EU Charter for Fundamental Rights. When the Commission started thinking about the new data protection regulation, it had to rethink completely the approach in terms of data protection in order to reflect the fact that in 1995, when the directive was put in place, only 1% of users in Europe were using the Internet, while right now most of our communication happens online as well as a lot of our activities. Therefore, the GDPR had to raise the challenge to address the issue of the 21st century and the fact that everything's happened online, to harmonize users' rights, and also ensure that the rules will apply uniformly across the continent to avoid administrative burden for the controller and the processor. In terms of users' rights, we have to say that most of the rights that are in the GDPR are a reflection from the 95 skeleton. They do strengthen and upgrade those rights by making explicit reference to the jurisprudence that have since been developed by the EU Court of Justice, and also creates a series of new rights that have been mentioned by my fellow panelists. Some of the most important ones are the right to portability, which raises a lot of challenge in terms of operability, and the right to object to automated-based decision, which includes profiling, which is one of the biggest issues of the 21st century. This reflects the need and the wish of the users, shown by many results of surveys and Eurobarometers conducted in Europe, whereby for many, many years, more than 67% and 80% of users, the different rates shows the increase in the rates over the years, are concerned about not having full control over the information they provide online. This does not mean that, of course, they won't share information, because there are services out there that the users want to have, but this must come hand in hand with a control and an empowerment about this data. The GDPR does address part of this concern, but when it regards to the enforcement, this is where we expected the most revolution from the GDPR. A lot of the issues from the 95 directive was the fragmentation in the implementation, the fact that some data protection authorities were better equipped than others to actually implement the regulation, the fact that some country took more time than others to actually put into practice the directive, etc. So having a harmonized regulation should have helped for a clear enforcement, which would benefit both the users and the company in order to do cross-border commerce, since the same rule would have applied everywhere. But on that specific part, the regulation has actually fallen a little bit short, becoming a sort of hybrid instrument between a regulation and a directive that we now call a regulative. As you probably know, that the GDPR has much flexibilities left to member states as the 95 directive has of articles. All these flexibilities are potentially a risk for fragmentation for both users and controllers, but they're also an opportunity for the national parliaments to work closer in order to bridge this gap and ensure that this fragmentation does not happen and the promise harmonization take place. One of the examples that is left to the national member states is on the representation of data subjects, so the Article 80 of the GDPR. This is a very important article for both the data subject rights and the enforcement of the regulation. This article was originally a requirement, but it has been made after the so-called trilogue discussion, a flexibility, leaving the possibility for member states to choose whether or not they will implement a provision allowing for so-called collective redress, whereby NGOs like mine or consumer groups are allowed to represent users in front of data protection authorities or in front of court in order to lodge complaint on their behalf. This is particularly important for users' rights, as we know that they are worried about the fact of not having control over their information, but at the same time, a little above 30% of users only know about data protection authorities. There is a double issue that needs to be addressed. First, there is a crucial need to raise awareness about the data protection authorities, their role, and what they are here for the users. But in order to do that, developing a collective right to redress in each member state will also help users that probably doesn't have the capacity or the time or the energy to also bring cases in order to make sure that the rights that are encompassed into the GDPR are properly enforced. Going beyond proper enforcement of the regulation, which has been strengthened by the cooperation mechanism, the consistency mechanism, by the creation of the board, even if this raised a lot of questions of how this will function in practice, the GDPR actually introduced a very innovative element that would make potentially data protection and privacy move beyond the simple compliance perspective to embedding privacy and data protection as part of our cultures. This is already the case in a large number of countries. The fact that Portugal has in its own constitution enshrined a right to private life show that it didn't need to have a data protection directive or a data protection law to consider those issues. However, this is not necessarily the case in all EU member states, and this is why we need those instruments, those regulations, in order to ensure that some citizen does not have greater rights over others and that all EU citizens enjoy their right to data protection and privacy as they should be, since it's protected in the Charter. The data protection by design and data protection by default, which are the Article 20 of the GDPR, is a concept whereby the controller would consider and the processor would consider from the very early phase of conception of a service, of a product, the data protection element of the product they're developing. Let's take, for example, a controller that would be developing an application. This would mean, instead, if you're seeing data protection as merely a compliance issue, you have an idea, your engineers develop it, and then at some point, right before the launch, it goes to the compliance department. They check with the applicable laws whether it's comply with privacy or not and other types of legislation, and if it does not, you need to alter your product. This could be costly because your idea has been in the move already, and if the compliance department come back with a lot of edits to do on your product in order to be able to be launched in the market, this could mean potential losses or delay in losses. However, okay, sorry. So I'll be brief. However, if you include data protection by design within your mechanism, it means that from the very conception phase, the engineers will be thinking of, do I have to collect all of this data for my application to function? What is the least minimum amount of information that I need in order to deliver the service? Why am I thinking to collect more data? How do I want to use this information? What information am I going to give to the users? By doing so, when the product do arrive to the compliance phase, it will be easier and faster to go through because privacy has been considered from the very beginning and there will be very less element for the compliance team to review. And this will also ensure an easier enforcement of the rules since privacy will be fully part of the culture and not seen as something you have to comply with, but something you truly defend as your product and become also a sales force for your product. This is important for the users, as I mentioned, because it will make sure that their rights are respected, but it's also important for all the companies in Europe right now that are actually already complying with data protection law, and this is the case for many, many companies, and that are worried that with the development of the GDPR, something new and very complicated has arrived to them when most of the rights enshrined were already there. It's a matter of stronger enforcement. It's a matter of going after the company that have not been respecting those rules. But for those who's been compliant for all these years, they have nothing to worry about. There is indeed really heavy fines, but those fines come with a lot of condition. It comes with repetitive infringement. It comes with the fact that if you're notified by a data protection authority and another authority that, or the fact that you're not compliant, it means that you would get a fine if you refuse to comply even after notification. Basically, the enforcement mechanism is made to ensure that there is not an unfair competitive advantage for companies that are not respecting the data protection rules over the other that have been doing the right thing for many, many years. Since we are running out of time, I will just leave you with a few recommendations that we have in general, which are mostly addressed to government and data protection authorities in a sort of a to-do list of things to do in order to ensure robust enforcement for the user's sake and also for the controller's sake. First of all, as I mentioned, is creating these measures for collective redress in every member state to make sure that the citizens have additional tools to enforce their rights. Create incentive for data protection by design in order to develop this culture of privacy. And the second two are specific messages for government in order to make sure that the board are efficient, data protection board is efficient. Data protection authorities across Europe need to be allocated proper resources in order to function and in order to also ensure that more users know their rights and stand up for their rights. We need to promote awareness around the GDPR and the rights that are encompassed. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Stel. Sorry for the pressure. We have to get some time for the closing session. Temos então agora algum tempo para colocar questões para.
We have a short period of Q&A. I'd like to ask you to please stick to the model used successfully in the previous Q&A sessions. Those of you who would like to have the floor, raise your hands. Please introduce yourselves and say who you want to address your question to. So there's someone up the top who would like to have the floor. Are you able to reach the speaker with the microphone? If you can, please do. Uh, a suggestion from the panel is that maybe if there are any questions, we will try to collect and listen to the various ones. Good afternoon. I'd like to congratulate the different presentations and talks this afternoon. My question is for Professor Elshen Souza. I apologize to interrupt. Could you introduce yourself? I'm sorry, my name is Pedro Peralta, and I'm from Deloitte. So taking into account all of the things that still need to be done at a legislative level, inquiring about and analyzing the constitutionality, and the things which have to do with authority entities and the interoperability that will have to be set up between the different member states and different national authorities, if what is lacking until this regulation or the 20 months which are still ahead of us before the regulation is fully implemented, could we use this time to check whether the requirements are going to be applied at the same level throughout and covering all the companies or not? This portability right and my question vis-a-vis the portability right has to do with the creation of an additional risk. So companies will have, to a certain extent, will have the ability to export quite easily potentially sensitive information. And this cannot be used as a weapon turned against the data subject. Thank you for your question. My name is Pedro Vilarin Pires. I'm a lawyer. My question picks up on what has just been said, and it's for Catarina Sarmiento y Castro. I sort of heard a reference made to the right to portability and another important right, which is business secrecy rights. And my question is, how will you make these two compatible? Thank you. So now we have three questions. We will pass the floor over to the speakers. Namely, when it comes to a implementation in stages or a gradual introduction or implementation of the regulation, I don't have any information that that will be the case, and I don't think we can count on it. This is very demanding, but it has to be done. Otherwise, we will start off on the wrong foot and with several handicaps. I also don't see a way in complying with the regulation requirements other than through new legislation. When we were talking about the powers granted to the data protection authorities, it's important to bear in mind that the Portuguese authority is the one, as far as I know, with greater powers but limited resources. So this will also have to be taken into account when we are trying to harmonize the demands which stem from this regulation. The other question or the other problem raised in terms of portability is a right. It's a position awarded to people. People are entitled to this, but the companies and businesses don't have the right to make or render available to others their secrets or trade secrets or business secrets. and that is not what is being requested. But that cannot be used as a way to also prevent data subjects from being deprived of their own rights. And ultimately, and that's what the regulation serves, is ultimately the data subject cannot be in any way damaged with portability. And I can foresee many difficulties arising in the future because of this portability aspect. But legally speaking, the intent is to protect ultimately the data subject, not to cause any damage or loss of protection. Thank you. I liked the fact that that question was raised because I also have many doubts concerning this. And maybe this was not an innocent comment that I made in terms of data protection and the fact that this is legally complex. And we have paradoxical aspects. In public administration, where we see and have public interests at stake and fundamental ones for community, for how administration works, how the state works, and for economic activities and so on, to be able to get states to establish information exchange between the different administrative organizations is often difficult and meets so many hurdles and barriers due to precisely interoperability issues. Obviously, this has to happen. It's ourselves as consumers of the public administration that we demand that this is done in this way and that interoperability does take place. Something entirely different is when we're talking about the portability of private data. Private data in private operators, for instance. And I thought that this was used as a an argument, a weapon of argument. But in actual fact, the more harmless, in a way, as the regulation warrants and demands, that the technology is, there are always a series of specificities that if I actually export data I have on a given application to that of a competitor, I'll either have an additional duty or job plus additional costs involved in doing this. Otherwise, I may encounter several problems if I don't go the extra mile to do what is necessary in providing the information in the correct way so that there is no breach. And as was mentioned, this may turn on the citizen. And it was discussed when it was still in its draft stage that whether the information was not too vulnerable, that the information would not become vulnerable if it was able to be transferred to someone else or to a competitor. And maybe that's why I said that this was more a consumer's right than data protection right. Maybe it's a useful tool. Whether it's a crucial tool, I don't know. I'm sure that the court will be called in to rule on this because this will generate a conflict, no doubt. Thank you. Given that we have already exceeded the time allocated for the session and I don't see anyone wanting to ask a question, although I do apologize. Someone has just raised their hands. I wasn't looking closely. Okay, we will give the opportunity for one last question before we move to the closing session. I would like to end with this provocation. We have, in a way, more advocacy and litigation, in a way, in actual fact, than anything else. Often we talk about privacy, but not so often of access. We talk a lot about, well, putting it in another way, there's an issue which we are discussing around the world, and especially in Europe, and e-government priorities, and the difference between privacy and openness. And this is my increasing conviction that privacy is protected by oneself. Those who, let's say, choreograph or the system, in other words, cross-referencing citizen's card information. Who does this? The state. It should be the citizen, the individual, doing this. The citizen can choreograph his or her own data, have access to this data, and under the law has access to the data, not just the taxpayer records, but access to all of those and the information about all of those who can alter impersonal information. And so we're talking about administrative data and information. And this is the challenge I wanted to raise. And as I said, we have a lot of litigation and little citizenship. And I think this is also something for civil society to discuss. Thank you very much. Professor Elshender, would you like to comment? Just a very brief comment. As Luis Vidigal knows, no doubt. The new document was published in July, and those who are concerned with these matters, I'd just like to draw your attention to the concept of nominative document, as is described and has been described, is not the one with personal information or does not have private information but personal data. And that is how it's being perceived or looked at. It's important for those who have a greater interaction with this and just for those who may have not noticed this yet. Okay, thank you. We will now formally conclude the session. I'd like to thank all of you for attending, your participants, the audience. Many questions will have potentially been left out in the open and in the air, and hopefully we'll be able to come back to them in the future. Thank you very much to the organizers for this event, and we will now move on to the closing session.
Good afternoon. I would, with your permission, Minister, I would like to thank all of you for having come. I would like to thank all of you for your participation, the questions you asked, and the discussion that we had. I would also like to thank the speakers for such an enriching day. I would also like to thank the National Data Protection Commission for this initiative and for allowing us to do it together. And just as Dr. Rui Mascherano said at the beginning, in terms of the portrait from his association, it is important to promote a debate around a number of topics which have to do with the development of society. And I'm talking in terms of the Standing Committee for Safety of Information. And so we are focused on these topics of public policies, etc., of the different users of public policy, all the different strands of public policy. We look at today at the legal strand, but there is a technical strand, an economic strand, and the way they complement each other. But also within the group, we look at the topic of safety, security, and privacy. And we're interested in the conflict between public policies. That is, in terms of rights, how, what kind of conflict it is, and so how we can improve things. Now, in our group, this was discussed by our group. I'd like to thank Mr. General Almeida from the group who helped organize this event, and I would like to tell you what this group actually is. So we focus on these topics that I mentioned. The purpose of this group is to promote the development of public policies, the promotion of trust that was spoken about today, the promotion of the improvement of knowledge in new opportunities and emerging risks, and the promotion of the creation of an active attitude in society that Dr. Vidigal was talking about in terms of citizenship and the promotion of the citizen. And the intervention of the citizen in the debate, and we had to look at the different views regarding these topics. We want to do that at the initiative of the group, or at the initiative of the group in partnership with other authorities, public or private. We have done this, we intend to continue to do so, and in the group we have identified the fact that there are three lines of action. One line of action that has got to do with the protection of personal data. Another line of action has got to do with another EU instrument, which is the transposition of the Directive on Safety Networks, Information Safety Networks, and another topic of our interest. We already organized an event of this type, and we want to do this again. That is a conference on safety and privacy in an information society from the point of view of the lessons learned. That is, we want to take stock of what actually happened up to a certain time, make an appraisal of the current situation, and what one thinks is going to happen. Now, as regards today's event, I would like to point out two or three things. In terms of the concepts, well, We spoke about people's rights, but people's rights are not the same thing as the user's right, because the person and the user are not one and the same thing, or the holder of the rights. And so the consumer and person are not the same thing, and all these three things together are not the same thing. As citizen, now we can be talking about rights belonging to different entities, and these are different, and the role that these different persons play in society, or that a human being plays in information society, all these roles are different. And so, and in addition to the improvement of cyberspace, we only have human beings. We have computers acting on their own behalf and on behalf of people. We don't know whether they have the right to act on behalf of people. Another notion we were talking about is the notion of risk. So when we think about risk in this regulation, it addresses the notion of risk as from a negative viewpoint. And in terms in the group, we address risk more from the viewpoint of the fact that what evolved from the technical norm in the OECD guidelines, and the notion of risk as the effect of uncertainty in the entity's objectives, but whether this entity is a person or a company or a public entity. Now, these effects are positive effects and negative effects. That is the notion of risk that we're addressing. Is not this a notion close to calamity or tragedy, but it's a notion that looks at detours or deviations in terms of expectation. And so there we manage to, with a slight alteration of the notion of risk, we manage to see this notion from the perspective of minimizing negative impact and enhancing positive impact, for example, linked to innovation or technological innovation. There's a slight nuance here. Another point that I would like to raise to conclude, it has got to do with the notion of personal data. Now, what we have seen is that there's a chain of production of information. Underlying this, there may be personal data, but the fact that the work of this chain results in other data, that given the notion of personal data, which is in the regulation that was already in the directive, which is allowing for the identification of a person directly or indirectly, raises the question whether the data that is produced by that processing of information belongs to whom? Does it belong to the company or the user, especially when the user didn't provide it, didn't even produce it. It was the company that produced it. And so we have to think of this notion, for example, these electricity meters that exist in several countries. Minister? I would like to turn to the representative of the National Data Protection Association. I would like to thank you very much for giving me this opportunity, and I would like to invite these people who participated to belong to the group outside. There's a little leaflet where you can become members of the association, and if you want to enrich your association with your participation, we would like to thank you. If you're very busy, well, then at least give us your suggestions of what you would like to see us discuss. Thank you very much.
Minister of Justice, Your Excellency. Members of the APDSI, Ladies and gentlemen, the work today proved that there's still a lot to be done, ideas to discuss, a lot to accomplish. And I'd like to add to this some misunderstandings to clarify, but I will leave these out. For us, the CNPD, the Portuguese National Authority, we will continue to work towards ensuring the fundamental rights of citizens, specifically relating to data protection, privacy, and privacy in their lives, and ensuring the fundamental right to freedom. So we are working here and wanting to continue to work to try and ensure the proper execution implementation of the new regulation, and we are available, as we always have been, and we are now available to, together with the main decision makers, to find the balanced solutions within the spirit of our legal tradition and within our constitution. I'd like to thank all for the interest displayed in this conference. And I'd like to also clarify, because I know that many may also have this interest, that the presentations will be made available on our website. Allow me to especially thank the Parliament services, the Secretary General and the Deputy Secretary General, for having greatly contributed towards the success of this event. To the Minister of Justice, I leave you my utmost thanks for honouring us with your presence here during this closing session, which I'd like to interpret as a sign of the importance the government warrants to the implementation of the European legal framework, which I see as a positive sign for the future in data protection in Portugal. Thank you very much. I apologize. At this time of the day, I would rather stand up and speak, not only because it is late, but also because it's really hot. President of the CNPD, of the APDSI, Director General of the Security Department, Director General of Cybersecurity, dear guests, ladies and gentlemen. It's for me a huge honor to be here at the closing session of this conference, which has dealt with very important and timely matters, which unfortunately during the 21st century, not only citizens, public and private entities have not yet considered to be deservedly important. I thank the CNPD and the APDSI for the invitation addressed to me. When in 1946 humanity witnessed the creation of the first computer, the so-called ENIAC, electronic numerical integrated computer, weighing 30 tons, 33 meters long and 3.3 meters wide, I think that the whole community and legal community was very far from imagining the complexity of data processing. And with the right to protection created then, the legal experts were far from contemplating what the future had in store. In the 70s with HESA, as well as in many other fields, the Portuguese Constitution consecrated the fundamental right, the right to the protection of personal data, which was taken from the OECD 1980 Alliance and the 1991 Convention of the Council of Europe. But in fact, the Internet itself between 89 and 91, when it was created, when Tim Berners-Lee and its future democratization took place, that citizens became aware of the importance of data protection. Legal discipline on personal data protection, which has moved hand in hand with the privacy regime, although they are not to be mistaken, is in charge of processing personal data and its protection, and also cloud computing related issues and the so-called Internet of Things. In the society we live in, information and communication society, the exchange of personal information is a constant, transforming our communities into vigilant and monitored societies. In our own homes, our own space of personal privacy, we are constantly being spied on by utilities companies, for instance, which collect our data for invoicing purposes and record all of our consumption. When we go to a shop, a supermarket, the products we buy are recorded, which enables consumer profiling, and often our data is provided willingly for membership cards, and this reveals what we hold as most intimate and private information, our lifestyles. The electronic means of payment, such as debit and credit cards, also leave a trace of our consumption and tastes. Presently, none of us can live without phones, tablets, downloading more and more so-called free applications which allow us to check our bank statement, shop online, look at the weather, or simply keep up with what our friends are doing. As the British say, if you're not paying for the product, this means that you are the product. And this brings me to question the price and the cost of this new virtual world. I'm convinced that the new generations will see the rise of a new currency, that of personal data. The value granted to information is increasing. Information concerning us are a valuable asset for companies which use it to improve their efficiency levels, but also use it for more immediately profitable activities. Not only, personal data are of capital importance for governments and public authorities, and in fact, without any specific knowledge of their citizens, the state machine could not correctly collect taxes or provide basic services to populations in areas such as health and education. Apart from this, personal data is also crucial to fight criminality and to ensure the well-being and safety of citizens, which are increasingly faced with threats, which dictates, therefore, the collection of more and more data, resorting to more and more ICTs. The importance and interest of data protection is, therefore, cross-cutting through the public and private sectors, revealing an increasingly globalized society where technology progress happens at an alarming pace. Ladies and gentlemen, the content of the regulation and the circumstances of its approval and enforcement have been, no doubt, discussed in depth by the experts who spoke at this conference. But allow me to also underline some aspects which I consider warrant being mentioned. 2018 will be the decisive year. It was mentioned earlier that we still have 20 months. Okay, 2018 will mark the beginning of this new regulation, 23 years after the 9546 directive came into force, and more than 6 years after the Commission's proposal was submitted to, and which aimed at revising the regime in force resulting from the directive. In 2012, the European Commission presented the so-called data package, aiming at looking into the existing system, revising, updating, modernizing as a result of the 2007 Lisbon Treaty, and encompassing the different transpositions and updates of the various member states on the 9546 directive. Personal data as a form of currency within the framework of the big data has made it necessary to revise the rules in place. And it seems clear that there was an attempt to reinforce citizens' rights without creating additional bureaucracy, nor by imposing successive obligations to those who process the data, be it public or private entities. I'd also like to mention the importance of this regulation and the timeliness, also the importance of it including children's protection rights and many other protection rights on sensitive data and others. Concerning data subjects, we are going to see a reinforcement of the right to information and three rights which have been called for many years: the right to be forgotten, or the right to be erased, meaning that there's an irretrievable suppression of data, plus the right to know who processes the data, plus portability rights. The articles on those in charge of processing, such as data controllers, also are important references. Also, the important notification of data processing is an important aspect which prevents the breach of data. In handling data processing of a sensitive nature, it's now mandatory to not only assess the impact, which should then be reviewed, but also prior consultation mechanisms. Yes, another innovation which is worth underlining, such as those pertaining to data controllers, which has to do with creating the new position of DPO mandatory in the following circumstances: when we're talking about public authorities or institutions, except for courts, when we're talking about large quantity processing, or when we're talking about sensitive data. In terms of controlling activities, authorities, and the national authorities in general, these are in charge of following up the best practices and liaising with the European Board. This new regulation will require the intervention of the national legislator, which is mandatory when it comes to establishing fines, and optional in terms of other aspects concerning data processing in very specific circumstances. The Ministry of Justice participated in the negotiations on the data package protection, or data protection package, within the police and judicial cooperation in criminal law and is fully aware that these represent a novelty, be it for citizens and businesses, and justifying an incorporated approach. And that's why this initiative of the CNPD and of the APDSI is of a timely nature and is especially important in raising awareness and disseminating issues pertaining to data protection within this new framework. I understand that the state, through its institutions, should have an educational role, namely in terms of in legislative instruments, international and national, that they have impact on national life. As Minister of Justice, I am personally committed to pursuing these objectives, and in this sense, I want to make it public that the Ministry of Justice, through the DG on Justice Policies, will also organise in November, as I also had the opportunity to tell the CNPD President, conference on European instruments concerning personal data, to also provide more information and debate to civil society on the matter. Thank you very much to all.